whose title was Darius, and Daniel simply calls him by the title. We don't know much about this, and we may, if more things are discovered, know, be able to identify with more certainty this Darius the Mede. But there is a case that many find convincing for identifying Darius the Mede with this general under Cyrus, who ruled in Babylon under Cyrus' authority for a while, shortly after the fall of Babylon. And that would fit well, fairly well, the details given in Daniel. There are some who think that that is not a likely thesis, and there are some who think that Daniel is simply referring to Cyrus as Darius the Mede. If you look at chapter 6 and verse 28, Daniel 6:28 says, "So this Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian." Now, it looks like a distinction is made between Darius, who is here obviously Darius the Mede, and Cyrus the Persian, because it says he in the days of Darius the Mede and Cyrus the Persian. But the word "and" in the Aramaic can be explicative, which means it doesn't make a contrast, but it actually adds information to say even rather than "and." This is true in the Greek also. There's the word "and" can mean even, as if it's explaining something. For example, in Daniel 7:1, where it says, "In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head." Some believe it should be translated "a dream, even visions of his head." The word "and" in some context can mean even in Aramaic as well as in the New Testament Greek. And some feel that in verse 28 of chapter 6, we should read it, "Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius, even in the reign of Cyrus the Persian," so that Daniel would here be telling us that when he speaks of Darius, he's talking about Cyrus. Now, this is another thesis that is supported by many scholars, and there are some things in its support, but it can't be proved. No current thesis as to the identity of Darius the Mede can be proved at this point. But that should not be considered to be a weakness in Daniel. It's simply a weakness in other historical records. Daniel has proven to be more accurate than other historical records already on the matter of Belshazzar and other things. Daniel tells us about this man Darius. It's simply that other historians failed to mention him, or failed to mention him by that name. So we simply can't be sure who he is in comparison with known figures from other records. But to fault Daniel's historicity on this would be certainly a mistake. Now, I just want to comment here that this story illustrates what Nebuchadnezzar learned. He learned that the Most High God rules in the kingdom of men and points over at whomsoever he chooses. And Belshazzar knew the story about that, but he hadn't learned the lesson. And he learned the lesson that night, a little belated, to do him any good. But it certainly illustrates it for future rulers who would defy God. And rulers do that sort of on a regular basis. Rulers often want to make gods of themselves. In fact, the next chapter, where Darius agrees with a law to forbid the prayer to any god but himself, is not too uncharacteristic of pagan kings in general. And yet God will not tolerate any other gods in his universe. There's only room enough for one god in the universe, because he fills all in all, and the heaven and the heavens of heavens can't contain him, according to Solomon's words. And for that reason, anyone else who sets himself up as a god above or additional to the God is simply, challenging God to crowd him out, because God doesn't have room for any rivals in the universe. He's just too big, not room for more than one God. So a man who sets himself up above God is just a courting disaster, and this story is one of those places that tell of it. Now, historically, from outside the Bible, we know that the conqueror of Babylon was Cyrus. And quite remarkably, the Bible tells us that also in a prophecy made long time before the event, in Isaiah chapter 45, actually the closing verses of Isaiah 44, as well as the opening verses of chapter 45, tell us about Cyrus and actually name him. as I've told you before, Isaiah, however, wrote his prophecy about Cyrus about 200 years before this event, and 150 years before Cyrus was born. Cyrus was around 50 when he conquered Babylon, and therefore the prediction that he would conquer Babylon was made 150 years before his birth and 200 years before he actually did it. And it would be peculiar, very strange, if Daniel, the writer of Daniel, would have made some mistake as to who the conqueror of Babylon was. Some skeptics think that the writer of Daniel mistakenly thought that Darius was the conqueror of Babylon, not Cyrus. As we've pointed out, though, Darius might be another name for Cyrus, or it might be a reference to Cyrus' general, who, along with Cyrus, led the troops in. But the method of conquest is what is more particularly interesting. Certainly Belshazzar left himself vulnerable, one might think, by bringing all of his chiefs of staff, all his military officers, all of his chief guys, 1,000 leading government employees to this feast and getting them all drunk. I mean, who's going to defend the city? Well, they weren't too concerned about that. According to the records of people like Herodotus, the city was defended by walls. The Babylonian walls were said to be 300 feet high, which is like a 30-story building in height. Now, there aren't any 30-story buildings in this town. I imagine in Portland you might be able to find some 30-story buildings. I know that when I've been in Honolulu, I've counted the stories in some of the tallest buildings just to get an idea of how big a 30-story building is. And there's some buildings in Honolulu that are a lot taller than 30 stories. But I checked out a 30-story building once, and I thought, man, it's hard to imagine with ancient methods of construction being able to construct a wall 30 stories high. It just kind of dizzies you just trying to look to the top level of it. And according to the historians, this 300-foot-high wall was 80 feet thick. And that it was, whether this was ever done or not, we were told that they were capable of racing chariots in eight lanes on top of the wall. And it was like an eight-lane highway on top of the wall of Babylon. It's too thick to burrow through or knock down, too high to climb over by any ladders or anything like that they had in those days. The wall was simply impregnable. It was also quite long. I mean, it's quite a feat. It's not like the Great Wall of China by any means, but the wall was the city was a 15-mile square, so it was like 60 feet of this huge wall around the whole city. 60 miles. Did I say 60 feet? Excuse me. Yeah, it was 60 miles circumference, 15 miles square. There were, as I recall, 100 gates into the city, but they were all of cast bronze, which was one of the strongest metals known at the time, and therefore, again, impregnable. But as you may have heard, I know I've mentioned it earlier, I don't know if you recall, the city was conquered because it had a notable weakness, and that was that the Euphrates River ran through the city. In order to do that, this river had to run under the wall. And this is history. The Bible doesn't record this, although it predicts it. It doesn't record the actual event. But this is what happened this night that we're reading about. When Belshazzar, what happened was Cyrus and his troops diverted the flow of the Euphrates waters so that the riverbed that ran under the wall dried up. The waters went another direction. And therefore, there was a dry riverbed going under the wall of the Babylonian defenses. Now, the Babylonians were not absolutely stupid. They no doubt anticipated that someone might try something like this, and we are told that they had bronze gates in the riverbed to prevent someone from invading that way. So even diverting the River Euphrates wasn't the cleverest thing in the world. There was still, that was anticipated, and there were gates there to prevent entry. However, according to secular historians, the gates were opened from the inside to admit the Persians in. And no one knows for sure who opened the gates exactly. If you read in the Encyclopedia Britannica or some other secular historical treatment of the fall of Babylon, they'll suggest that probably sympathetic supporters, perhaps spies inside the city, opened the gates to let Persian armies come in. That's a possibility. We're not told in the Bible or in detailed history anywhere how those gates were opened, but they were. What is interesting is the prediction about it, found in Isaiah chapter 45. Isaiah 45 and verse 1 reads, "Thus says the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have held, to subdue nations before him, and to loose the armor of kings, to open before him the double doors, so that the gates will not be shut. I will go before you, and make the crooked places straight, and break in pieces the gates of bronze, and cut the bars of iron." Now here, 200 years before the event, Isaiah the prophet, who had never even been to Babylon, probably didn't know anything about the walls of Babylon, speaking under inspiration of the Holy Spirit, predicted that a man named Cyrus would be the deliverer of God's people, delivering them from Babylon. The earlier verses at the end of chapter 44 point that out. But specifying that God would open before him the double doors and the gates will not be shut. Well, it's unlikely that Cyrus had read this or that his sympathizers inside the city of Babylon had read this, but they fulfilled it. Or else maybe God supernaturally opened the gates. We don't know. But because the gates were there and the Babylonians assumed the gates to be shut, the defenses of Babylon were considered to be inviolate, that there was no way that anyone could invade that city. There was no technology of the day that could get over or through those walls. And yet, the self-confidence and false security of Babylon was repaid with conquest because, as history records, the Persians took over the city without a war, without a fight, without a battle. I mean, all the nobles and the generals and stuff were drunk at Belshazzar's party. The defenses were down. And so the Persians marched right in and took the city. They killed Belshazzar. And who else they may have killed besides, I don't know, but they didn't kill Daniel. And Darius, as we say, we don't know who he is for sure, but whoever he was, came to supreme power in Babylon under the Persian power initially and elevated Daniel to high position. That's what we read of in the next chapter, chapter 6. It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps. Again, the word satrap literally means protector. And it was like a provincial governors, to be over the whole kingdom. And over these, three governors, of whom Daniel was one, that the satraps might give account to them so that the king would suffer no loss. So 120 satraps and three overseers of the satrapy. One of these three overseers was Daniel, which means that these three men had the highest position in the government under the king himself. Now, it's interesting that it doesn't tell us the names of the other two who shared the honor with Daniel of being over the other satraps. The fact that it mentions there were three instead of just one is one of the marks of authenticity of the story. It doesn't bother to name the other two because they're not important. But if someone's just making up the story, they could just say, if they wanted to point out how Daniel was superior to the others, they could just say, and Daniel was made over all the satraps or something. If they're making it up, that'd be a better way and a more natural way to try to write a fiction story about why everyone was jealous of Daniel. In this case, we're not told why they were jealous of Daniel in particular. They were, but why weren't they jealous of the other two in Daniel's office? We don't read of any attempt to destroy Daniel's peers in the same office. It's possible, though, that Daniel was the only foreigner holding such an office. Daniel, though he'd lived almost all his life by this time in the region as a captive, still was of the captive nations. He was not of the local ethnic blood. And it may be that for a man who had been from a captive people to be in such a high office caused more resentfulness on the part of those under him than, for example, if some of their own peers of their same race held the other two offices that we don't know anything about. All we know is that the kingdom was set up in this way. There were 120 provincial governors and three men over them, and over those three men were just the king himself. And Daniel is in one of those highest offices. And it says, "Then this Daniel distinguished himself above the governors and satraps because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king gave thought of setting him over the whole realm." Now, we don't read that the king did that at this point, but he was thinking about it. And the news that Daniel actually was in a position of promotion, even above the others who held with him the highest available office, that it seems as if the king was going to create a new office above that of any existing office just to put Daniel in it. He was so impressed with Daniel's spirituality and wisdom. So the governors and satraps sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom, and they could find no charge or fault because he was faithful. Nor was there any error found in him. Apparently, Well, it says, and then these men said, we shall not find any charge against this Daniel unless we find it against him concerning the law of his God. Initially, they tried to find legal infractions on his part not relevant to his religion. In other words, they tried to, you know, they audited his income tax returns and things like that to see if he had done anything scandalous, anything that they could nail him for. They looked at his records and they had people spying on him, seeing where, if he's taking bribes anywhere. They just couldn't find anything. They were looking hard at him and they couldn't find anything because he was honest. He was faithful, it says. Now, not all Jews, not even all godly Jews, and not all Christians in the Bible could be said to be faultless in terms of secular law. As we pointed out before, there have been cases in the Bible where people defied the laws of the land. The midwives who would not kill the Jewish babies in the days of Pharaoh, for example, they defied the king, they broke the laws, but they were godly in doing so. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in refusing to bow. And later in this chapter, Daniel, he defies the king also. But when it comes to laws that were not infringing on the law of his God, he was blameless. He would never get involved in civil disobedience if it was not the kind of thing where the law of his God was at stake. And Christians are not at liberty to violate the laws of the land simply because they don't find them convenient to obey, or simply because we don't have a lot of respect for the people who made the laws, or because the laws that were made are not the ones we approved of, or that the people we voted for would have put in. The Bible indicates, of course, that the authorities that be are appointed by God. But it also indicates that when those authorities put themselves above God, we must honor God above them. We have to stand against them, and that's what eventually happened here. These men knew that though they couldn't find any legal infraction on the part of Daniel with reference to the laws of the kingdom, they figured they could if it came to something of the law of his God. They knew that Daniel had put his God first. He had never been in the position to have to prove that, but somehow they knew that his religion meant more to him than his job, even than his life. And therefore, if they wanted to get him out of the way, they had to find some way to put a conflict between his God and his king so that he could not be obedient to both. And they were quite sure what choice he would make. He would go with God and against the king if it came to that. So they concocted a plot. These governors and satraps thronged before the king. Interesting how the word thronged is used there. I mean, that's an unusual word. They could just say they came before the king, but thronged suggests a huge crowd of them, like a throng of the masses. It's like they all came storming in, crowding out his chambers. You know, I mean, 120 of them in his courtroom in his throne room apparently would be a throng there, more than was accustomed to being there. But they all came, as it were, in mass, to try to give the impression that there was a general agreement about what was being proposed here. And they said to him, King Darius, live forever. All the governors of the kingdom and administrators and satraps, the counselors and advisors, have consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree that whoever petitions any god or man for 30 days except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. Now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing so that it cannot be changed according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which does not alter. Therefore, King Darius signed the written decree. Now, why would he do this? Was he on a power trip? Did he have delusions of himself as being a god above all gods? I don't think so. He was not personally offended when he found out that Daniel was praying to a different god than himself. In fact, he did everything he could to get Daniel delivered from the penalty. Darius didn't have any aspirations to be worshipped necessarily, like some kings have. But he didn't have Christian convictions either, or Jewish convictions. As far as he was concerned, there's zillions of gods, and if people want to treat him as God, it was good politically. It was a wise political move, because he had just moved into position, taken over a captive people, a conquered people, and people tend to be more loyal to their religions than to their God, than to their kings, many times. And he was the new king. But if he could also become the focus of their religious adoration, it would secure his power more readily of the conquered people. If they would worship him, if they'd pray to him, if they'd replace their gods with him, it would consolidate his power over the new kingdom more. And no doubt it was strictly for political reasons they did it, rather than some aspirations of wanting to be a god. After all, the decree only had to do for the next 30 days. After that, they could worship other gods if they wanted to. The idea would be that 30 days would be enough to set a precedent that everyone had, by the end of that 30 days, will have worshipped the king, will have acknowledged him to be yet another god in their pantheon. And while, you know, if a king is seen as only a man, then citizens might think, well, wait, he's a man, I'm a man, I could overthrow him and take his place. Which, obviously, a lot of people thought that way in history and have done so. There have been such things as coups of kings because their citizens knew that those kings were mere mortals and could be replaced by another mere mortal. And that's one of the things that motivated kings to take on divine powers, or the impression of divine powers, because people would not think themselves capable of overthrowing a god. And so, just to sort of set a precedent, he agreed that for 30 days, no one could pray to anyone except him. Now, it's hard to know whether Darius had any thoughts about Daniel in this. Did Darius know that Daniel would not go along with this? And if he didn't know it, how did he not? He certainly had observed Daniel's life and integrity enough to want to put him over the whole kingdom. How he could hardly miss the fact that Daniel was loyal to his God. It was probably just an oversight. I mean, the king has many things on his mind, and here's all these satraps, and they come to him and say, all the satraps and all governors have consulted, and we all agree together to this. Well, that, of course, wasn't true. Daniel had not been consulted. Apparently, all except for him had been consulted, and yet the king had the impression that they were telling the truth, that this was a unanimous thing. All of them agreed to go along with it. Apparently, even Daniel did. He might not have even thought of Daniel as a separate case in this instance. He just, as a non-Jew himself, he didn't have sensitivities about idolatry, and he probably forgot for the moment that Daniel might have sensitivities about it. In any case, he signed it into law, and he later regretted it when he realized that Daniel wasn't compliant. He didn't regret having elevated Daniel. He regretted having made the law. He didn't want to go against Daniel's convictions. He respected Daniel, and he wasn't doing this in any way to force compliance on Daniel. It was an oversight on his part. He was misled. He wasn't thoughtful. He failed to consider Daniel's convictions in this matter. And had he considered it, I doubt if he would have signed it. Because, as I say, he later regretted signing it. The problem is that unlike the Babylonian system, where the king could make a decree and then he could just revoke the decree on a whim, the Medes and the Persians had a custom that when a Persian king made a decision, it couldn't be changed. Now, that might seem like a stupid law to have, or a stupid policy. You know, it can't change it. Can't a man change his mind? Well, probably the reason for having this policy that the laws of the Medes and Persians can't be changed once they've been decreed by the king was to prevent the king from making hasty decisions. I mean, if he knew that he could never get... It's sort of like, you know, if you live in a society which doesn't permit any kind of divorce, you're going to be much more careful about getting married in the first place than if you're in a society where divorce is quick and easy and cheap and painless. You might get married at the drop of a hat, again and again and again. You know, I mean, where there's an easy out, it's kind of easy come, easy go. And yet, it's possible that the Persians had a conviction that their kings ought to be very careful about the laws they make, and that it would help to keep them careful if they had a policy that once they made them, they couldn't change them. And that was the policy. So Darius wasn't careful enough in this case, but he seemed to have the unanimous counsel of all of his subordinates on this, and it was certainly something flattering to him. Politically, it seemed probably a wise thing to do, to consolidate his new power in the new conquered region, and he just wasn't thinking about every aspect of the problem that it would create for Daniel, so he went ahead and agreed to it. Now, when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went home, and in his upper room, with his windows open toward Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees three times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days. Now, why do you do that? I mean, why do you do it with his windows open, where people could hear him? Can't God hear through the walls and the windows and so forth? Obviously, Daniel knew he could. Obviously, there were other Jews at other times in history who practiced private prayer. In fact, Jesus even told his disciples, when you pray, go into your closet and close the door, so that no one knows that you're praying. And of course, Jesus didn't mean that in a legalistic sense, that it's wrong to pray if anyone knows it. But he was just saying you shouldn't show off in your prayers. You shouldn't try to show off your eloquence in prayer and try to curry, you know, admiration from the religious crowd because of your praying. It better to keep it just between you and God. But here, it's interesting how verse 10 is worded. It says, when Daniel knew that this writing was signed, he went and did this. Now, I don't know about you, but I would be inclined, if I knew today that the Congress had just passed a law that anybody who goes to a Christian meeting will be fed to lions in the Colosseum. If I knew that law was passed, if that was printed in the front pages of the Los Angeles Times or whatever, or the Oregonian, you know what I'd do? I'd stop going to church publicly. I mean, that's what my first impression would be, and I probably would do that. I'd probably just join the underground church, you know? I mean, that's what they did in Russia and China and a lot of other places. When it becomes illegal to be a Christian, you just go underground. But without such a law, I fellowship freely and openly. Now, is there anything wrong with going underground? I'm not aware of there being anything wrong with it. The disciples, even Jesus, on the night of his betrayal, was, it seems, in hiding. His enemies needed someone to direct them to where he'd be. He was sneaking around at night and so forth, it seems, without people knowing where he was. I mean, to hide out when people are trying to kill you is not forbidden in Scripture. And when Daniel heard that this was going on, it says he didn't change his practice. He just kept the windows open, prayed out loud to God, acted like there had been no law made. Now, if Daniel had at this point said, uh-oh, for the next 30 days, I'm going to pray with my windows closed. I'm going to pray silently. I'm going to make sure that no one else is in the house when I'm praying so I don't get caught. He would be doing what almost any of us would do, what most Jews and most Christians in the Bible did or would do. He did something very unusual here. And it's quite clear that what he did was intentionally to be in the face of the king and to defy those who were trying to intimidate him from praying. I don't say that what he did, he was required to do. That is to say, there's no place in the Bible, nowhere in the law, that says three times a day a Jewish exile in Babylon needs to bow toward Jerusalem with his windows open and pray out loud. There's no law that required that. He could have changed his prayer life somewhat. He could have prayed silently. He could have done it less frequently. He could have done it more privately. He could have altered his regular practice, but he didn't. And we're not told that he became more ostentatious about it than before. We just read that he did as was his custom since early days. He didn't change anything. He didn't allow the intimidation of this threat of death to change his behavior. Now, I guess what I'm trying to get across is I don't know that it would have been wrong for him to allow it to change his behavior, but he wanted to kind of... I believe that what he was doing was trying to make a statement, and that was that I'm going to worship my God according to my conscience, publicly, and threats of death don't scare me, nor do royal edicts from kings. I'm just going to do what I'm going to do because it's the right thing for me to do. It's what I've done before. I mean, it's not like the Bible required him to pray three times a day, but that's what he'd been doing before. Why change it? Just because some king said to? What's that count for? Some king telling me to change the way I worship God? No thanks. I'll do it my way and let the king worry about what he's going to do in response to me. Now, we got to remember, Daniel was a very old man at this time, too, in his 80s, at least. This was about 70 years or more after he'd been taken into captivity, because he was taken into captivity in 605 B.C., and this was now, it doesn't say which year of Darius's reign, but probably right at the very beginning of Darius's reign, that'd be about 539 B.C. We're talking about 65 years he'd been in captivity at this point. And he was a youth, probably an adolescent when he went in, so he'd be about 80, I would think, if he was, let's say, 15 when he went into captivity. He'd been there 65 years, he was 80 years old. A man 80 years old has outlived even the biblical allotment of 80 years and 10 of the average lifespan by 10 years. He probably figured, well, you know, I'm not too young to die, and if I'm going to go down, worshiping God. I'm going to go down doing what I would always do. I'm not going to be intimidated by death. What, am I supposed to live forever or what? You know, I mean, 80 years old, you die one way or another, whether I die in my bed or die in the mouth of lions. I'm not going to worry about it. I'm just going to do what I would do ordinarily. And I'm going to make a statement to the king that I do not acknowledge such decrees from kings. I don't acknowledge any decree from a king that impinges on my loyalty to my God. And he was much more upfront and public about it. I mean, he didn't go out in public and do it, but he wasn't more careful than before. As any of us would normally be more careful if it was illegal to do what we're doing. We wouldn't be having this class right here in this manner if it was illegal to have Christian meetings. We'd be either not doing it at all, or else we'd be doing it in some cellar, you know, with someone watching the windows and the doors to make sure the cops weren't coming. We would do it differently. But I guess he figured, well, he'd lived a long life. If he died, he died. He's going to make a statement. And he made it. Verse 11. Then these men assembled and found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God. And they went before the king and spoke concerning the king's decree. Have you not signed a decree that every man who petitions any god or man within 30 days except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions? The king answered and said, the thing is true, according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which does not alter. So they answered and said, well, that Daniel, who is one of the captives from Judah, does not show due regard for you, O king, or for the decrees that you have signed, but makes his petition 3 times a day. Now, it appears that at this point the king saw through their whole plot and he realized that they'd trapped him. I take it that this is the king's reaction here because he worked so hard to thwart what they were doing. And by the time he comes to the end of the chapter where Daniel has been delivered, the king is very quick to throw the rest of these guys in with the lions. I mean, he's not real happy about these guys at all. He realizes that they have manipulated the king to do something which was they knew to be against the king's will. You know, people who are subject to a king are supposed to be interested in promoting the king's will. And if the king had shown an interest in promoting Daniel over the kingdom, these people should be supportive of it. But instead, because of their jealousy, they manipulate and deceive the king in order to get rid of the man that the king really wanted to honor. And so they clearly were traitors. And he realized at this point, it says, and the king, when he heard these words, was greatly displeased with himself. Not with Daniel, interestingly. Here, Daniel's defying him. It does say, and the king was very displeased with Daniel for this, when he heard it. No, he was displeased with himself, and set his heart on Daniel to deliver him. And he labored until going down of the sun to deliver him. Now, when it says he labored to deliver him, it must mean that he consulted all the lawyers and everyone he could to find out if there's some loophole here. It's not as if there was any strenuous physical work he could do to deliver him. He was probably looking for every legal option open to him to exempt Daniel from the rule. But it says, these men approached the king and said to the king, know, O king, that it is the law of the Medes and the Persians that no decree or statute which the king establishes may be changed. So the king gave the command, and they brought Daniel and cast him to the den of lions. But the king spoke, saying to Daniel, your God, whom you serve continually, he will deliver you. Now, this statement of confidence that Darius made to Daniel, as we see later, was not so much a statement of firm conviction on the part of Darius, but more like wishful thinking. It was well wishing. I hope this is true. I'm saying what I hope is true. Because the king didn't sleep well that night. He didn't have any real confidence that Daniel was going to make it through that night. But he wanted to encourage Daniel that he was on his side and sympathetic, and that he certainly was hoping that God would deliver him. Perhaps this king had heard stories about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, which would encourage him to believe that Daniel might conceivably be delivered. Now, by the way, I certainly believe that God can deliver me from a den of lions, but I wouldn't always be sure that he's going to. There are many, many Christians who died in the arenas fed to the lions in, you know, the 2nd and 3rd century when the Romans liked to feed Christians to lions. They didn't stop the mouths of lions. They were eaten by lions. Now, some might say, well, they just didn't have enough faith. Daniel had enough faith, and these people didn't. That's not necessarily the case. Look with me over at Hebrews chapter 11. As the writer of Hebrews is trying to outline some of the high points in the Old Testament of what faith has accomplished in different individuals whose stories were well known, he says in Hebrews 11, beginning at verse 32, and what more shall I say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, also of David and Samuel and the prophets. Now, Daniel would be one of the prophets. who through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, became valiant in battle, turned to flight the armies of aliens, women received their dead raised to life again. All those stories that are alluded to are Old Testament stories. Some of them refer to David, some refer to Elijah, some refer to other cases. Certainly, the stopped the mouths of lions clearly is a reference to Daniel in the lion's den. Now, Daniel wasn't the only person whom God delivered from lions. Samson was attacked by a lion and he tore it apart like a kitten. And David often had to protect his sheep from animals, and once at least he delivered his animals from a lion. And he says he struck the lion, apparently with his sling initially, and he came over to get the sheep, and the lion rose up against him. He grabbed it by the beard and struck it again at close range, apparently not with his sling, since he wouldn't be able to do it from there. He probably did it with a club or a rock or something, but practically with his bare hands, like Tarzan, you know, David killed a lion. And Samson done so too. But it's not likely that those are the specific cases the writer of Hebrews has in mind, which is stop the mouths of lions. Killing a lion is one thing, stopping their mouths is another. And certainly that is specifically what happened to Daniel. The angel of the Lord was sent to hold the mouths shut, or to shut their mouths. So the writer of Hebrews is referring to Daniel there. And then the next case he says, and quench the violence of fire, almost certainly referring to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But the important point is that in verse 35 it says, and others were tortured, not accepting deliverance that they might obtain better resurrection. Still others had trial of mockings and scourgings, yes, of chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, they were tempted, they were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and mountains and dens and caves of the earth. And all these, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not live to see the fulfillment of the promise. Now, notice this. He gives a catalog of great exploits that were done by men of faith. You know, they turned to flight the armies of the aliens. They escaped the edge of the sword. They stopped the mouths of lions. But others didn't escape the edge of the sword. Some were slain with the sword, or tortured, or imprisoned, and so forth. There's two categories here of people. All of them equally faithful. All of them equally men of faith. The ones who were delivered from adversity and the ones who suffered adversity through faith. And we could easily say that although some have stopped the mouths of lions by faith, others didn't. Others died at the mouths of lions. Although some quenched the violence of fire by faith, as in the case of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, others, many Christians throughout history, didn't quench the violence of fire. They were burned up at the stake. Not everything that has ever been accomplished by God in the way of delivering his people can be counted on in every case to be God's plan. sometimes God does, and sometimes God does not deliver his people. And so even Daniel himself could not know for sure whether God would deliver him in this case, just like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego didn't know for sure whether God would deliver them. They said, we're not going to bow in any case, but, you know, God may, he can. He can deliver us from your fire furnace, but if not, we're still not going to bow. Daniel, I think, when he went into the den of lions, didn't know what his fate was going to be. And therefore, the king certainly couldn't have known any more than Daniel. And so when he said, your God, whom you serve continually, he will deliver you. As I say, I think that was more wishful thinking than anything else. But it turned out to be true. Then a stone was brought and laid on the mouth of the den, verse 17, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the signets of his lords, and that the purpose concerning Daniel might not be changed. Now, this seems like going overboard, since the king really didn't want Daniel to die, that he put a stone over it and sealed it, obviously with a signet. All of this was to forbid any tampering, that Daniel couldn't have any friends come and deliver him because it's shut. But apparently the law, which we've only had the briefest mention of up to this point, probably specified that this kind of thing had to be done. When someone was thrown in the den of lions, it probably had to be sealed by the king's seal to avoid any tampering or rescue by anyone. Now the king went to his palace and spent the night fasting. So did the lions, by the way. And no musicians were brought before him. Also his sleep went from him. Daniel probably slept well enough, probably leaning up against a nice warm lion. But the king couldn't sleep. That's the problem with being in authority. You make dumb decisions and you have to live with them. Sometimes you can't sleep over it. But the man of God, his conscience was clear. His decision that he made was obviously the right one, and he was at peace, we have every reason to believe, there in the den of lions, once he saw that he was delivered. He might have even seen the angel that he later mentioned had come to save him. That would be very encouraging. Then the king arose very early in the morning and went in haste to the den of lions. And when he came to the den, he cried out with a lamenting voice to Daniel. The king spoke, saying to Daniel, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions? I wonder if he expected to hear any answer. Then Daniel said to the king, O king, live forever. My God has sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths, so that they have not hurt me, because I was found innocent before him. And also, O king, I have done nothing wrong before you. Then the king was exceedingly glad for him, and commanded that they should take Daniel out of the den. The decree had been fulfilled. He was thrown in the den of lions. He was even kept there overnight. There was no law that said he couldn't be taken out the next day, dead or alive. So the demands of the law had been fulfilled, so he could take him out unhurt now. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no injury whatever was found on him, because he believed in his God. And the king gave the command, and they brought those men who had accused Daniel, and they cast them into the den of lions. Them, their children, their wives, and the lions overpowered them and broke all their bones in pieces before they ever came to the bottom of the den. You'd think that that's a little fast. I mean, the time it takes them to fall to the bottom of the den would be only a split second. How could the lions kill them and break all their bones that time? Unless the entry to the den of lions was a slope, you know, where they had to kind of walk down there, or they were pushed down there and they'd roll down. The lions maybe never let them reach the bottom level. You know, the lions came up after them and got them and tore them up. It seems rather sad that their children and their wives had to suffer this fate. We do not read that God ordained this death for these people, but God does ordain that people die somehow, and this is kind of a gruesome way to die. It's not unlike the decrees of pagan kings to not only get rid of their enemies, but the whole families of their enemies, lest their children surviving them may grow up with a grudge against the one who killed their father and lead a revolt someday. It's easier just to get rid of the whole bad lot, bad seed, you know, bad parents, bad seed, so they get rid of the whole family. Then King Darius wrote, to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom, men must tremble in fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God and steadfast forever. His kingdom is one which shall not be destroyed. Borrowing languages from Nebuchadnezzar's earlier decree in chapter 4, apparently. And his dominion shall endure to the end. He delivers and rescues. He works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, who has delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. So Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. You know, the thing I'd want to point out is that Daniel was in Babylon principally because God was punishing the Jews. The exile in Babylon was a punishment to the Jews, to the bad Jews. But why did the righteous have to go? Why did the remnant have to suffer with the wicked? Well, obviously, there was a second reason for that, and that's so he could be a witness to these pagan kings, and decrees could be made publicly by pagan kings commanding everyone to honor the God of the Jews. You see, sometimes the righteous suffer too, along with the wicked, but God always has a purpose in it. God always can bring fruit from it. We might think, well, I shouldn't have to suffer. I'm not the one who brought, you know, God's anger on our society. But God doesn't do anything foolishly or without reason. And Daniel, who was not guilty of the sins that led the children of Israel into Babylon, yet became very instrumental in bringing the knowledge of God to the pagan world there. So we'll have to stop right there.